Today we are fortunate, blessed, or lucky to have the wonderful Mel. He is one of the people I got to meet at the start of the pandemic and just love seeing him. So Mel, take as long as you need, and it's always a pleasure to hear you share space with you, sir. Thank you for your
Thank you. Hi, my now you. This is not an AA or NA. It's like a whatever you make it.
Or
So,
fellowship.
how do
It's
people usually,
AANACA.
and how do people usually introduce themselves by how they do at their meetings or
Anything.
anything? Okay.
However you wish, sir. Alcoholic, addict, you name it.
Okay. Hi, my name is Mel. I'm an addict, an alcoholic. And some people say I'm sober today. They don't want to say they're an addict or alcoholic. I used to, after one of my LSD trips, and I had, and I was like connected to the universe, I was quite sure that what I said, the words that came out of my mouth, played a large part in defining who I was and the world that I was in. So, I can understand being very careful about people being careful about saying, "Oh, I'm an addict." That means I am now solidifying my being an addict, you know, which people might not want to do if they think about it. But I don't care. I don't care at this point. Anyway, so that's why I'm addict, alcoholic, and let's see. I usually start. You know, I went to a elementary school. I went to a religious school, and it was half like religious stuff half the day and regular school stuff the other half of the day. And the eighth graders graduated to go to high school, the ninth grade. And I have a feeling the customs are different in other countries when high school starts, when what you call high school. But anyway, there's not too many of us here, so there can't be too much of a cultural diversity, so to speak. Anyway. So I was 13 years old, 12 or 13, and some friends of mine got together with me. And the graduating class takes this, they call it the Circle Line tour. It's like a ferry that goes around Manhattan Island. And the graduating class did that. It's like a nice thing to do for the kids that are graduating. So we decided we were going to get a bottle of booze to bring with us on this trip. And one friend of mine got it, and there were like five of us or so involved. And as soon as I got to the school, somebody handed me a bottle of booze, and I stuck it in my jacket. And a few minutes later, my teacher came over to me, and he said, "Mel, you don't have any firecrackers on you, do you?" Because I was known for things like this. That could possibly get us in trouble or me in trouble. And I said, "No, no firecrackers," but I had the bottle of booze in my pocket. And so we went on the trip. And you know, when as a kid, I had this feeling like adults can't really see us. I had a feeling like older people, like the world, they live like in an old world, and they can't really see like young kids and what they're doing. And so we were sitting in this bus going to the boat, to where the ferry was going to leave, and we were throwing coats over our heads on the bus, drinking from this bottle. And when we got to the boat, the captain, we sat down like in an audience, and the captain gave us instructions. But told us about the boat. Orientation, he called it. And we were sitting in the audience throwing coats over our heads, thinking that they people aren't going to see what we're doing. So then he said, "Okay, you can walk around the I don't know if it's a boat or a ship. I don't know if you heard that. That's a delivery of some kind. My bell rang. I'm going to have to not answer it. Anyway, if there's anything important, I just blame Mark for it." But anyway, he said, "Okay, now you can take a walk around the boat." And I went to walk to the lower deck, and I saw two of everything. I saw two staircases and two handrails. I saw, like, I don't know if it's a river or ocean, whatever the hell we want. I saw two rivers, and That's the first time I saw double from drinking. And when I got to the bottom of the steps, it didn't take long before someone said, "Hey, the captain told the teacher that we're drinking and we're going to get in trouble." So we all ran into the bathroom. We finished off whatever was left in the bottle. We all got sick. We all threw up. We all got in relatively big trouble. And some people were supposed to get awards for their the science award, the English award, and they just crossed their name off the program, the graduation program. Anyway, I got my mother, what she said. She said, "If you're going to do something stupid, at least don't get caught." Those were her words of wisdom. And she was humiliated. You know, she had to sit there with me while the board of directors, the head of the board of directors, told her that I was drinking alcohol, 13 years old. Anyway, so much for that. I always throw that in because I want to throw some booze into the story. Since I go to AA and mostly drugs, I did mostly drugs in my career. Let's see. I went to college. I went out of town just because I wanted to. My family was fine. I didn't really want to get away from my family, but I thought there'd be young people and friends if I went to an out-of-town school. So that's what I did. And I am not a good student. I don't read. I can read, but I don't know what I read. So I am not a good student. I got into a good college because I was able to like figure out what answers to put down in tests and stuff. So while I was there, I drank, ate pizza, drank, and then I flunked out. And when you flunk out, they figure, well, I flunked out because I was in a new environment and I was uneasy. And so they give you you can take a semester off. And then come back again, and maybe then you'll do better. So I took a semester off, and while I took that semester off, my cousin turned me on to pot, and I smoked pot for the first time, and I became like an expert on pot. I started buying large amounts of it, and in those days you had the seeds and twigs, and you would the pot culture has changed so much. I don't know what's real to people, but we used to take the top of a shoebox and put the pot into the top of the shoebox and break it up, and then the seeds would roll down and you would have the pot that you could smoke on the top. Anyway, now I don't think pot has seeds anymore. They grow in some new genetically pure way with this, like no seeds. I don't know how they do it, nor do they want to tell me. Anyway, no, they also probably don't want you to grow it yourself. That's another reason that there aren't seeds in it. So I went back to school and I brought this a big fraternity mug filled with pot, strained pot, and I ended up selling pot while I was in, when I went up there. I didn't want to sell it. That wasn't my goal, but people started asking me for it, so I started selling it to them. And I brought some LSD with me. I had not taken LSD before that, and it was like new to the world at the time. It's like 1964 or so, and at least to the popular world. And so I read this article in a local newspaper, and it was some woman who took LSD, and she was screaming. And during this trip, she was screaming and saying, "Oh no, when is this going to end? This is horrible." And I said, "Boy, that's something I want to try." So I found my upstairs neighbor had that stuff, so I bought some from him and took it with me up to school. I took LSD up there. I had a very, very good trip. It was like I don't know. Profound, awesome, enlightening. It was quite amazing. And I had some bad trips after that also. Bad, bad, bad. As good as the good one was good, the bad one was bad. And bad ones. And I flunked out again. And this time I'm not sure why, a combination of the LSD I had taken and I think psychologically the failure of school, and when you're a kid, everything is like drawn out for you. You're going to go to this school, you're going to go to the school the next year, and then you go here, then you go to high school, then you go to college. And when you flunk out of college, the road just stopped. And now it's like, what do I do now? And there is like no instructions anywhere what to do now, unless your parents tell you. I was like at a loss, and I maybe psychologically I found myself being pretty sure that I was the Messiah, and that was that was not bad, by the way. If you can have some psychosis or something like that, Messiah is a good one, because it's good stuff. It's not like some people have a, they're psychotic and they have a bad time. I was having a good time until the police brought me in and brought me into Bellevue, which is a local hospital here in Manhattan. And anyway, so I was there for a while, and they shot me up with the stuff called, at the time it was Thorazine. Now that and which was disappointing, because that if you think you're the Messiah, and all of a sudden the Messiah-ness is taken away in a few seconds with this with the Thorazine, it was not fun. I joined a like a religious cult. They call it a cult, and because I wanted to get back to that good LSD trip I was on, I thought maybe I could do it. This, anyway, I was into it for a while, and I took some more LSD a few years later, and again, I was pretty sure I was the Messiah, and again, I got involved with the police. I can't go through the whole story. It was quite entertaining if you weren't me or the or you guys or the police, but it was they brought me into another psych hospital, and time had gone by, so now they were using Haldol instead of Thorazine to remove my religious aspirations, whatever, to take away the Messiah-ness from me. I but now the first time I felt the first time that happened, and they. I felt bad afterwards. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who I was. But the second time that it happened, I felt pretty good. I knew that I was right. I just kept my mouth shut this time. I didn't tell everybody I was the Messiah. I kept my mouth shut, and things were like really clicking for me in this earth. And I was getting along well with everybody, and I started working in a business with my father, and a cousin of mine turned me on to cocaine, and that made a big difference in my life. I loved cocaine. To me, it was like the cherry on top of the sundae. And I was into this religious view of the world and stuff, and I was reading the Bible. I was reading Revelations, and in that chapter, somewhere somewhere in there, it says, and there's a white rock. It says this in Revelation somewhere, and the white rock. And I said, that's it, the white rock. God is talking about cocaine. I am on the right track. This is the right thing to do, and that validated even further this everything I did validated the road that I was on. Until the well, the police had already brought me in. But anyway, what happened? The cocaine. At one point, aside from snorting the cocaine, I was smoking it, and I started smoking it. And that's they call that crack. If you make it yourself, they call it freebase. It's like it just changes the molecular structure of the cocaine, so it burns at a lower temperature. You can smoke it. You can't smoke the stuff that you snort. You gotta mix it with some baking soda or something. Anyway, so that's what I did, and I love this stuff, and it's the kind of thing that you can't stop doing it. You take a hit, and you exhale, and a few seconds goes by, and say, "I think I'll have another." And I started to get like I started to get like pains in my chest, and in my arm, and in my jaw. And I took out the book, and I looked it up, and pains in my and said, "The signs of a heart attack: are pains in your chest, in your jaw, and in your arm." So I went to the emergency room, and I went there like a few times. At that time, there was a well-known American basketball player that died from a cocaine overdose. And prior to that, cocaine was not considered a dangerous drug at all. But then when he died from it, then it became a dangerous drug. So anyway, I would go to the emergency room, and they say, "Oh, don't worry about it. It's only the cocaine. You can go home." So I would go home, and I would continue smoking it, and that happened a few times. Now, if you, I used to have a rotary, like a push button telephone, and I used to smoke this cocaine in a water pipe with a blowtorch. That was the height of the technology at the time. And so there's a blowtorch, and you put the cocaine in, then you light it and take a hit. And I didn't want to go back to, I didn't want to call, I didn't want to go back to this to the emergency room. So what I would do is I would on my phone. I don't. We have an emergency number here in the United States, 911. If you dial 911, it's for police or doctor or stuff like that. So what I did is I would dial nine, take the receiver off the phone to make it live for people that never saw a phone. There are nowadays there are people that have never seen a regular phone. A non anyway, I would dial 9-1 on the phone, and then I would take a hit from the pipe, figuring that if I get a heart attack, all I have to do is press the other one. I would open the door slightly, so I would all I would have to do is hit the other one, and the police would come and get me, even if I had a heart attack. So that was my plan. That's what I used to do, and I did that a few times, and I'm still here, so I didn't get a heart attack. Anyway, the cocaine, for those of you that don't know, if you do enough of it, you get like paranoid. I would get like I would take binoculars and start looking out my window, seeing if I every window that I looked in, I thought I saw women undressing, and they weren't. They were not. Most of them were not women undressings, but in my mind, if I saw a shadow a certain way, I would say, "Oh, that's her elbow." There was always something that I could turn into being a woman. Anyway, so I was glued. I was glued to the binoculars, looking out the window, and one day I thought the police were going to come. I thought someone reported me to the police, and I got scared, and I. At the time, I was smoking cocaine, and it has these little. It's like little for people that haven't smoked it. It's like you. It's like a white thing, and you break it up into little pieces. And I was afraid if the police come, you know, I was more afraid they were going to take my cocaine away than they were going to arrest me. But I took the cocaine. I have a cat and a litter box in the bathroom, so I took these little white pieces of cocaine, and I placed them very carefully in the litter box, in certain places in the litter box. So if the police came, they couldn't differentiate what's the cocaine and what was the cat litter. So the only problem was I couldn't differentiate it either. So when it turned out that it was not, I was pretty sure it was the police. I looked through, I looked at the, I had a hole. I didn't have a doorknob on my bathroom door, so I was in the bathroom looking out this hole in the door, and I can swear I saw a police dog, and that he had just eaten my cat, and I was sure they were coming. Anyway, it turns out they didn't come. And then when I went to retrieve the cocaine from the litter box, I couldn't figure out what was what, and I smoked a lot of cat litter. And anyway, that's the cocaine litter box story. Let's see now. Okay, so anyway, I did a lot of cocaine, and one day the building, I live in Manhattan in the area called the East Village, and I was here for many years, and I didn't know anyone in my building. And I lived on the top floor. I didn't know any of the people. And then one day I saw a guy walk into my building who I knew from college. And he got to college because the court sent him to college. He got caught selling drugs, and he was a very smart guy, so the judge thought he would do better in school than in jail. So they sent him to the school that I went to. And while he was there, of course, he sold drugs. That's what he did when he got there. And I saw this guy that I knew from school walk into my building. And it turned out that this guy that I knew well now, even I knew him from school, he was the guy supplying my whole neighborhood with drugs. So I instantly was introduced I went from not knowing anybody at all to know anybody who was anybody in my neighborhood having to do with drugs. And it was like instant trust from all the worst people. But anyway, let's see. During this talk, you may experience moments where I forgot entirely what I was saying. So you may have to sit through a few seconds of those. Well, one day, my th this this there was a one of the people that I met is one of the drug dealers in my neighborhood, and he figured nobody knew me. The police didn't know me. He figured he could leave all his drug paraphernalia and stuff in my apartment. It would be safer there than with him. So he left that in my apartment. He left a bag of stuff, various powders and stuff in the there was a whole bunch of pot, but then he took the pot away because I was smoking it. And he took the cocaine out because he knew that he didn't trust me with that. But he left there was some bag of heroin, which I had not had before, and there was some various things that he used to cut the heroin. And so I investigated, and I took a little of this and a little of that, and finally I found the heroin, and started to do that. He was upset because he told me that he cuts that stuff like 5 times. I did much more than actually cut into his money because I was using a lot of it. Anyway, this is my cat. He's a pain in the ass. Anyway. But what happened was I was snorting this heroin, and prior to this, I couldn't get the cocaine out of my mind. I was constantly buying it, snorting it, smoking it, and I didn't inject heroin. I snorted it, and I noticed that when I snorted it, it didn't feel like very strong. I didn't feel like the amazing. People talk about heroin; it's the worst thing in the world. And I snorted. I didn't notice anything very strong about it, but I did notice that it took the cocaine out of my mind. I didn't care about the cocaine anymore, and so I guess that it was stronger than it seemed. If it removed the desire to do the cocaine, anyway. So then I started doing heroin, and as I found out that if you do enough of it, you become addicted to it, and that's what happened. If I didn't snort the heroin in the morning, I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to take a shower. I didn't want to leave the house. I didn't want to do anything. So I had to go running around the street looking for heroin at 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning. By the way, I was not the only person at 6 and 7 in the morning looking for heroin. And in fact, there was a I went down to a park in my area, and there were people on their way to work dressed in suits and stuff, sitting on benches, getting ready to buy heroin in the mornings. Anyway, what happened was at what happened was well, I just an aside. At the time, I was working with my father, and when I had this LSD, this Messiah thing, my relationship with my father improved, and I started, and he invited me to go into the business that he was in. He was like a jewelry one person jewelry thing. He'd buy and sell secondhand jewelry. And he decided to take me into his business. So that's what I was doing. And then when the cocaine and heroin hit, I was no longer a trusted employee. I mean, I might have been trusted, but I shouldn't have been trusted, because I ran out of my own money, and then I started just selling stuff. It's a good if your jewelry is a good thing to have. It's better to be like in a jewelry business than selling pancake mix or something. This is jewelry is you can turn into money. And so that's what I did. And it really ruined my relationship with my father. It was one of the worst consequences of my addiction. It was that, is that I had a really great relationship with my father, and this ruined it. Even though he didn't really, I felt it. He might have known something was wrong, but he didn't really know what it was. I just couldn't, you're stealing from somebody. You can't love them and steal from them at the same time. You can try, but it doesn't work, really. Anyway, it's not the same. Anyway, since I couldn't get to work in the morning without having some heroin, I decided to go on a methadone program. And for people that don't know, methadone is something that the state, I guess, it's a liquid, it's like a synthetic morphine, and you can they every morning you drink some of this, and it keeps you not needing any heroin for a whole day, and that's what I did. I went on this program, and first at first they didn't want to give it to me, because I didn't have any tracks on my arm because I didn't inject it. So they took a blood test, and they saw that I had heroin in my system. So they allowed me on that program. And so I was on this methadone program. And on this program, they can check your every once in a while, they would check your urine to make sure that you're not cheating and doing heroin or other drugs. And so I found out early on that they checked your urine to make sure it didn't have all this other this drugs and stuff in it, but they didn't check it to see if it actually was urine. So what I did is each morning I would make a little bit of tea, and I would put a drop of methadone in it and shake it up and carry it with me, and it surprised me, but it worked. That for 5 years they didn't. For 5 years, I got away with this make-believe urine that had methadone in it, so it's mine. I couldn't get it, like I said the other day, from my mother. Ooh, my mother's like, I'm not likely to get urine from my mother, but anyway, I couldn't use somebody else's urine. But so this had methadone in it, so it looked like it was mine. Anyway, but one day I was smoking a lot of cocaine, and I didn't have time to make this tea in the morning before I went to the program. So when I got there, they asked me for urine, and I gave them my urine, which I had never given them before in 5 years. And And a week later, the counselor called me and he says, "Hey, what's going on? We checked your urine. It has marijuana and heroin and cocaine and Valium and as I most positive decisions in my life, the reason I made those decisions is because I didn't want someone to yell at me. So I didn't want this guy to yell. He suggested that I go into a rehab, and I didn't want him to yell at me. So I said, okay, I'll go into a rehab, and that's how I got into sobriety. He got me into a rehab, and I mean, I never decided, like most people say, I couldn't take it anymore. It was miserable. I decided to stop, and it was not easy. I did not decide to stop, but there I was in the rehab. And once I got in there, I mean, my life was miserable. Believe me, I was stealing from my father. I was afraid I was going to get caught every single day. I used to feel like I used to feel that the devil had his grip. Had me gripped around the neck, and I couldn't get away. Oh, so anyway, so when I got to the rehab, I even though it wasn't my intention to get sober, I realized, well, whatever these guys got, I got the same thing, and it wouldn't be a bad idea for me to go back to some other period in my life where I didn't have this miserable life. So I did the rehab thing. They detox the rehab lowered detoxed me from the methadone that I was on, like a few milligrams a day, and I had a difficult detox. After in 10 days they lowered me down to nothing on the methadone on the on. They gave me methadone for 10 days in this rehab and lowered the dose down till I was on nothing. And when I was down to nothing, I was saying, gee, this is not so bad. I don't feel terrible. And I remember on the street, people said, oh, when you get off methadone, you're going to get sick. Your bones are going to hurt. Your teeth are going to hurt. It's good. And I didn't feel those things. But that day I slept, like, instead of sleeping 8 hours, I slept 6 hours. And the day after that, instead of sleeping 8 hours, I slept 4 hours. And the night after that, I didn't sleep at all. And the night after that, I didn't sleep at all. And that went on all the duration in the rehab, just about no sleep at all, maybe 1 hour or a half hour. If I was not in a rehab, which was it was located in a psych hospital, so the doors were locked, which really helped. If I had access to heroin or something, I would have done it. But I went to there was a meeting that used to come into the rehab, an alumni meeting. People that used to be in that in this rehab would come back and join the people that are currently in the rehab for a meeting. Anyway, and one guy there said, when he heard me share about, I haven't slept in 2 weeks, methadone, and he said that he was on methadone and he didn't sleep for 6 months, but eventually it got better. So hearing that made it possible for me to persevere. Although if not for that, I don't know if I would have had the confidence to continue. Anyway, so I started when I got out. My counselor told me to go to AA meetings. So I went to this group called the Midnight Group in Manhattan. I went to that meeting every day. In fact, two meetings most of the time. That 10 o'clock and a midnight meeting I used to go to. Anyway, while I was there, a friend of mine said, you know, he went to this meeting called We Agnostics of New York City, and I mean, I was not an agnostic or atheist, and I thought I was the son of God, so I certainly believed there was a God if I thought I was the son of God, but I didn't really. I anyway, so I don't really like to hear other people's opinions about this stuff, so I went to this We Agnostics meeting, and I liked it. I'm still going. It's like 25 years later, and I'm still going to that meeting. And you know, I when I got to AA, I don't know if people here have been to AA, but they have these in-person meetings. They have the steps and the traditions up on the wall. On these, they have these shades with the steps and the traditions. And I thought I was going to do the steps and get a sponsor and do all that stuff, but I didn't do it, and I didn't get a sponsor, so I had nobody coercing me to do the steps, so I didn't do the steps. And then over time, I saw, gee, I'm sober anyway. I'm sober. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. So I never did that stuff. But I would sit in the room, and I would see the steps on the wall, and I would look at them, and I would say, oh, no wonder I feel so shitty. I didn't do this, and I didn't do that step, and I didn't guess. So then when I went to the Agnostic meeting, they didn't have those steps on the wall. So I didn't feel shitty. There was nothing to look at to make me feel shitty. So I felt good about myself. And I continued to go to that meeting, to those meetings. And when COVID happened, which is it really was an amazing thing that all of a sudden, boom, no meetings. All the churches where the meetings were all closed, no meetings. And I don't know how I first heard of it. Someone called me to say, oh, there's a Zoom meeting. There's a Zoom meeting. And at New York Intergroup, I think they bought like 100 and like 10,000 meetings or something. They paid for everywhere in the country. I think they paid like for 10,000 meetings. So there was Zoom meetings to go to, it's pretty amazing that this the transfer of going from in-person meetings to Zoom happened like. Almost, what's the word they use? Not flawlessly, like with no, there's a term they use. It smoothly went from the meetings into Zoom. It was amazing. And a lot of people in other parts of the world, like you guys, a lot of people, and especially in the United States, in middle states, they never heard of agnostic meetings. There's people that were 30 years sober, never knew that these things existed. Secular meetings, they might call them, and it really opened up the sober world to secular meetings. I think I've come to pretty close to the end of what I might say. I'm sh there might be some knee slapping moments of something funny, but I can't think of any right now. So I guess I'll leave it at that. I don't know what you if there's any format that you do anything now, but I'm pretty f much finished with what I was going to say. And I've been sober a while now, 30 something years, and I don't do any of the stuff. I thought I would do it, but I never did it. I don't have anything against it. I just I don't. In my whole life, most things that I should have done, I haven't done. I should do it. I should still should do it, but I don't do it. I'm a lazy guy. I don't know how to explain it. But anyway, that's it for me. Thank you. And thanks, Mark, for asking me.